Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you all for joining, and thanks to Dr. Jones for taking time out of his busy schedule to join this session. My name is Peter Mitwoody. I'm a seventh-year MD-PhD student at the University of Mississippi in Jackson, and also serving as vice president of the American Physician Scientists Association. A little bit about Dr. Jones's background. He got his bachelor's in molecular biology from Millsaps College, and then went to medical school at the University of Mississippi. He then went away to Charlotte, North Carolina to pursue a residency in emergency medicine. And following that, he did a clinical trials research fellowship at Carolina's Medical Center. And he also has a master's degree in public health from the UNC Charlotte. And following his residency and research fellowship, he joined the faculty at Carolina's Medical Center for a number of years, before returning to the University of Mississippi Medical Center. And he quickly ascended the ranks to his current position as professor and chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine. And he's a very productive clinician scientist, and he has published well over 100 peer-reviewed manuscripts. He is currently the PI of a R01 grant from the NIH, which he investigates L-carnitine treatment as treatment for septic shock, and he's also a co-PI on NIH UM1 studying inhaled nitric oxide as a treatment for pulmonary embolism. In addition to his local institutional leadership, he recently was president of the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine, and he's also a proud husband and father, and maybe we'll talk about that some during this session. And I'll go ahead with the first question, but for those of you who are on here, if you don't mind, I'm hearing some feedback. So if you're not actively speaking, would you mind muting either your telephone or your computer? That'd be great. So my first question, Dr. Jones, is can you talk a little bit about your path to get to where you are today? And is this the road that you thought you were going to travel while you were in medical school?
Yeah. So let me know if you can't hear me or if you have a problem hearing me. I'm on a microphone. So my path has been a pretty direct path, actually. I have been enthusiastically seeking the scientific method since I was a child and have always been a very analytic, data-driven person who makes decisions mostly based on as much data as I can gather. So I think, you know, just part of my personality has always been with the bent towards research, and that solidified some in college as I had one of my undergraduate professors became a mentor, and I did a fair amount of research with him in college, and kind of through medical school, after the basic coursework, found myself seeking out opportunities to be involved with organized biomedical research. Because I have a keen interest in patient care and physiology, found that I was going to be a more natural fit for clinical research rather than bench research. At the time, there really had the concept of translational research had not emerged, so really began to focus more of my efforts in research on what could be done in the clinical setting, and that led me during residency, which I think was the pivotal point for me, was choosing a residency program that had a clinician scientist that was willing to mentor me as a resident. That, I would say, was the pivotal point in my trajectory to becoming a clinician-scientist. And without that connection and that mentoring, I don't believe that anything that I have been able to achieve to date would have been possible. So I think that was probably the most significant component of leading me down the path that I've headed down is finding a mentor with similar passion and then the ability and the willingness to have me as a mentee. And that led me to being involved with, heavily involved with research through my residency. Actually, basically every elective that I did was in research. And then led me to a clinical trials fellowship. The importance of that time was to develop the prerequisite knowledge and infrastructure that I would need to become a clinician scientist that could write and deploy investigator-initiated research. So I didn't really want to become a conduit for drug companies, you know, pharmaceutical or device companies to do their research. I wanted to be an individual that developed the ideas and the platforms and then implemented them from start to finish. And so that intense time of mentoring and studying that was also an important ingredient in the recipe that eventually led me into the position that I am today. So, you know, if I had to tell you any pieces of advice, if you want to be a successful researcher, it's going to be, number one, you have to be born with something that is what I call fire in the belly, or kind of an innate desire to do this, because it is a hard path. The second is to early on identify someone who's willing to invest the time in you, and it is a tremendous investment on the part of an individual. And then the third is to be passionate about running after the knowledge that you'll need to realize eventually what you want to accomplish. And if you keep those three things in mind, I think, although I didn't set out in my path with those particular things in mind, but those are the three things that I've learned as the necessary ingredients to becoming successful.
Thank you, Dr. Jones. So I'll go ahead and open the floor up. If people have specific questions, you can, I guess, unmute your microphone and ask Dr. Jones.
Yeah, so this is Brandon Fox. I have quickly to dovetail on that question. I've heard numerous times from really successful investigators that kind of the mentor you have right before you come independent is vitally important to your success. And so, Dr. Jones, can you speak on how you identified that mentor and what we could potentially do to identify someone that would really be, you know, that person that could springboard us into the career we're desiring?
Yeah, so I think the important the way to identify the mentor is you basically have two choices. The first is you look at the choices that you have in your local environment, assuming your environment is fixed, and you develop the research platform that interests you around the resources in that environment. So identify those individuals that that can help you achieve the goals for research that you have if you can't move. If you can move, then I would say identify what your career goals are in terms of what you want to be as a researcher and in what area, and go to the resources. So I'll give you an example. I am a primary mentor on a K-23 application, but the primary mentor for a neurosurgeon. Now, it wouldn't really seem intuitive at first that a neurosurgeon would have a mentor that's an emergency physician, but this particular person's career goals are to become a relevant clinical trialist in acute care trials in neurosurgical interventions. And so what I am, however, is I can offer expertise in how to design, develop, write, and implement clinical trials in the acute care setting. I might not bring the topical expertise that is needed, but oftentimes clinicians and scientists don't need topical expertise. They need methodologic expertise. Topical expertise can come from people who are not experts in research methodologies and deploying research trials. So, you know, I think don't get pinned into a box of you have to have a mentor in your specialty with your interests, because that's not necessarily the case. You need to find someone with a skill set that you need to develop and go after that skill set and learn that skill set. I do think that from my own personal perspective, developing a relationship with a mentor that you believe will be the individual that can mentor you through your career development phase to the time that you become independent, and have that be one or two individuals, I think it becomes extraordinarily difficult to try to have multiple mentors through different stages of your career, although that's not impossible. Developing a longer-term relationship with somebody who's invested in you, I think, is going to become more fruitful in the long run. And I think that the most critical component of the mentorship and the mentor is during the career development phase. So at the time at which you are applying for an independent investigator status or grant or award, your mentor becomes irrelevant to the peer reviewers at that time. The relevance of your mentor is really in helping you have the credibility and knowledge base during that time of career development.
Great. Thank you so much.
That's
great advice.
Yep.
Oh, it absolutely does. I appreciate it.
Dr.
Okay,
Jones.
I had a question.
Oh, go ahead.
This is Rama from Albert Einstein. I was just curious, during your MD-PhD training, were you exposed to clinical research at all? And if not, how were you able to bridge that gap to your, basically, to what you do now?
Yeah, so I think you might have joined just after. So I'm not an MD-PhD. I'm an MD, so I did not enter into the physician scientist track. I went through traditional medical school, and then most of my all of my research training came after my during and after my residency program. So, but as I was trying to explain earlier, my interest really in medicine dovetailed nicely with my interest in research, in the fact that it came together through the patient and through physiology. So that's how my interest in clinical research came about.
Other questions?
Does that help answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Zach. I was just curious. I don't know too much about research that's going on in emergency medicine right now, but I was curious if there are any significant standout areas in your field that you feel really need more research into, things that have heavy impacts on patient care, for instance, or diagnosis, or making sure that people get where they need to be to get the care that they need as soon as possible.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was just talking to a colleague earlier, and emergency medicine being a relatively one of the newer ABMS specialties, you know, we a lot of the things that we do and the ways that we treat patients are not heavily data driven, and so there is an acute focus at a federal level on helping develop the emergency care research enterprise so that we can make more data-driven decisions. From my perspective, the highest acute needs of emergency care research right now are in the areas of comparative effectiveness for high morbidity, high frequency presentations. So presentations such as acute coronary syndromes, how to make the diagnosis in the most cost effective manner is an example. One of the problems that we see in emergency medicine is over-utilization of testing, over-reliance on testing with the concept that over-testing mitigates risk of malpractice as well as ensures patient safety. But those things are not shown to be true. So we really need researchers who can go out and do clinical comparative effectiveness trials that show us the best ways to diagnose and treat these acute care conditions, or just you could even say acute care complaints. So how do we go about providing more higher quality, lower cost care to patients without subjecting them to, you know, over testing and over utilization of expensive, risky tests. So a lot of that falls into the policy realm also, but I think that's kind of the way that emergency care research is headed.
Thank you very much. And I don't, if you don't mind, just a follow-up question would be, what do you think are the best indications of success in these cases? Because from what I understand, most of the ways that success is assessed is by patients don't show up in the emergency room again. But do you have how can you long-term follow up with a patient? Is there collaboration with other physicians on the team that those patients see, or how would you deal with that?
Yeah, so I think that comes down to what the individual study is evaluating. So ED recidivism might be an important outcome. You know, it could be another example is, you know, I was recently involved with a trial that looked at a that investigated a method of quantitative pretest probability assessment and its impact on radiation in dose to patients in patients who presented and were going to be worked up for potential cardiac causes of their complaints. So, you know, that's an example of how can we use cognitive processes that we already do, but rely on those processes to mitigate risk and make care safer in terms of the outcome of less radiation to the patient. And although you can't put quantitative metrics to what less radiation means in the long run to the patient, we can all agree that that is a patient-centric outcome, a patient-centered or a patient-oriented outcome, because any patient is going to say, I want any test that's going to provide the same result with less radiation. So, you know, there's all kinds of different outcomes. It really depends on, you know, what you're trying to investigate. So return visits is an example. Radiation might be an example. Need for invasive procedures might be an example. There are all sorts of important patient-centered outcomes that can be investigated.
Thank you very much. Really interesting. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jones, this is Brandon Fox again. I have a question about emergency medicine and research. So we've heard from surgeons, we've heard from medical doctors. I know that emergency medicine is kind of somewhere in between. So how does your breakup between time in the clinic and time in the lab play out?
Yeah, so so I over the years, those times, that the amount of time that I have dedicated to clinical versus research has changed, but I would say now the balance that I have, particularly I have some administrative responsibility, is about a third, a third, and a third. So about a third of my time is clinical, a third is research, and a third is administration. I've been as high and as focused in research as 80% research and 20% clinical. But I would say that as a general expectation, as a starting faculty member, 25 to 30% research time and 70 to 75% clinical time is a reasonable place to start. And then as you gain grant, and that's assuming that you have no grant funding, as you develop infrastructure and get grants, that time will necessarily change. And the important point though is to be in an environment where you have the opportunity to change such that you have a supervisor or chair that understands the importance of the research enterprise, what it brings to the table, what it contributes to the department and the institution, and that they are willing to negotiate with you clinical release time so that you can focus more on research efforts as you become more seasoned, more funded, and a higher commodity.
Great. Thank you so much.
I have something of a follow-up question to that, Dr. Jones. As you've, I don't know how involved you were with administration at CMC, but certainly now a substantial amount because you're chairman. But do you think your research has suffered, or your clinical skills have suffered as a result of taking on the additional administrative burden? Or do you feel like since you are kind of at a good point, you've got some grants and things kind of flow about and you can hire other people, do you think this is that was why you were able to take on that additional administrative role?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So early in my career, the majority of the time that I spent in the first five, probably 6 years of my professional career was clinical. So I was about 80 to 85% clinical. And the rest research. And I had to do a lot of research, a lot of my writing, and other research activities, at times of the day when I wasn't doing clinical. So I would wake up early in the morning and work after everybody went to bed, on grants or paper or manuscripts. And so by doing that, I developed a strong base in clinical medicine. And I've always tried to maintain a fairly substantial presence in clinical. You know, during the time that I had my K-23, you have to be 75% dedicated towards research. But even in those times, I would try to make sure that I was working a relevant amount. So, you know, every specialty is going to be a little bit different what relevant means. But, you know, 1 or 2 days of clinical work a week. And I still try to maintain that even today. So I think once you develop a strong clinical base, that you will remain relevant as long as you maintain that as one of the focuses of your career. If it is not, and you want to, you know, focus more on, say, bench research, and eventually become 100% researcher and no clinical time, then, you know, that's a predetermined decision that you'll have to make. But for a clinical trialist, you have to be a relevant clinician. You have to have your pulse on clinical medicine and new therapies, or otherwise you become an irrelevant researcher and an irrelevant clinician. So it really comes down to what your career goals are, and your career goals for your research program, as well as for your patient care platform.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
But it is a balancing act. You know, it is a constant balancing act, and there's never enough time in the day. So you have to. You just have to learn to take deep breaths and realize everything doesn't have to be done immediately, and that there has to be some balance in your life. And as a young person, you have a hard time keeping that in perspective. But I think as you get more years under your belt and become more seasoned, that the importance of that becomes clearer.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Jones?
Hi, Dr. Jones. This is Gerald Lilly. I had a question. You mentioned that you got most of your research during residency and after medical school. And that's looking like that's how I'm going to have to get most of my research experience, because I'm not going for a PhD either, because I'm a non-traditional student and my wife wouldn't approve of it anyway. I got 3 little kids at all. But anyway, I guess my question is, how do you go about getting the research during residency? Are there programs, or do you have to try to make your way during the residency program?
Well, there are both. There are some residency programs that have a year of dedicated research built into them, and there are opportunities in some programs to be involved with research, which requires you know, you to dedicate time outside of the time that you have to that you're mandated to spend by the ACGME. I went the latter route, so I was able to, you know, spend extra time in my residency gaining some of those skills. And then the year after residency, I spent, you know, a focused 12 months on developing that skill set and that knowledge base. And then that transitioned into my career as a academic faculty member, where I went back and did the MPH courses and did some extra research-focused didactic education. So, you know, you have to be creative about it if you don't have a lot of dedicated time, say, through medical school, but it certainly is achievable. And, you know, even I have faculty members now who are in or about to start Master's of Science in Clinical Investigation, and it'll take them 3 years to finish those programs, but they're doing it while they're working a full-time job and raising a family. So you have to be logical and monotonous about your path, and recognize that, you know, that slow and steady wins the race most of the time. So it's just planning out the course, plotting the course, and staying with it.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Dr. Jones. This is Zachary Kiss again. I just have a question. It's not really related to research or anything, but I was just curious, what are your favorite 5 minutes of the day, if you could pick them?
Well, I have a lot of favorite 5 minutes. I would say that my most favorite 5 minutes is the time that I get to come home from, you know, doing what I do professionally that I thoroughly enjoy, and being with my family. You know, but I have a lot of things that keep me grounded. I think you have to try to live a healthy lifestyle. I wake up early. I have a routine in the morning where I try to get myself grounded by being quiet and spending a few moments, you know, undistracted, just with myself, not looking at anything work or social media or anything like that, but just kind of being still and being quiet. And then I exercise. I think those two things are very important for me as a person. Everybody's a little bit different, but those things keep me grounded. Early in my career, I think I had a tendency to become too focused on my professional aspirations, and over time that has transitioned, and I've managed to strike a much better balance in my life where I really treasure and value the time that I have outside of my career, and recognize that, you know, that is time that is important contributor to my overall success at work. So, you know, I have a lot of important favorite 5 minutes in the day. I really value the time I get to spend with my colleagues, talking about things that make me excited about my profession. So I'm sorry I can't give you just the only 5 minutes, but if I had to pick one, it would be the time that I get home, right after I get home, that I get to see my kids and my wife, and you know, see the importance of my family.
That was perfect. Thank you very much. I appreciate you entertaining my question. I always try to do the same thing and think about every day what's important to me, and it helps me stay happy and motivated through school.
Yeah, well, that's part of a healthy lifestyle. I think we all have a tendency in the profession of medicine to be overachievers and heavily focused on, you know, profession. And I can tell you, while that's important, it will eventually catch up with you in one way or another. So trying to maintain a healthy balance in your life and a respect for the fact that, you know, having balance is going to make you more productive in every area of your life. You know, that's an important lesson to learn early on.
Any other questions, perhaps from somebody who hasn't asked one? If not, we can wrap this up before too long, but I had a question, Dr. Jones. I found your president's message a few years ago when you were inducted as the SAEM president, and this is very relevant to me now since I am currently working on making my rank list for residency. And you talk a little bit about, in this column, you talked about the how you moved from Charlotte back to Jackson and kind of the difficulty and the reward from doing that. But I was just going to read this short thing. You say, you're talking about moving. You said, make no mistake, it was just plain hard to do to move. After being at CMC for 12 years, I left my job, friends, community, and comfort, but I gained perspective, energy, focus, and a renewed sense of purpose. Perhaps we all should move, relocate, or bring meaningful change into our lives every so often. I wonder how much more productive and happy we might all be if we did. And I was curious, do you typically recommend that students move away for residency or fellowship or both? Or I know you did, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of considerations that one has to take when they choose residency program and what's best for, you know, them personally, their family, where they fit personality-wise with different programs. But I think the point of that message was, as human beings are creatures of habit, and habit has a tendency to breed complacency, complacency is the enemy of productivity. And so, you know, I think that we lose sight of the fact that when we become complacent, we become a lot less productive, and change is difficult. So, you know, if you find yourself feeling somewhat comfortable, then you're not challenging yourself. And if you are choosing a residency program out of comfort, because it'll be the most comfortable place to be, then you're certainly not giving yourself credit for what you need. And you probably need to choose somewhere else that you think is going to be a challenge. Because it's only when you're challenged that you, you know, really see what you're capable of. So, you know, I found that when I moved, you know, I had fallen into a routine and a comfort that, yeah, I was, you know, I was productive, but I was nowhere near as productive and energized as I could have been simply out of habit and comfort. You know, I think it's important to always keep sight of that in your professional career, that, you know, make yourself uncomfortable, because that's what challenges you to be better.
That's great. Thank you. All right. Other, maybe a few more questions and then we can wrap it up. Anybody else have some questions for Dr. Jones? Okay, well, I guess we can wrap it up. That's about 45 minutes, about what we like to go. So I'd like to thank everybody for joining the session, and thank you, Dr. Jones, for taking the time to speak with us. I think it was a great session, and it was very enjoyable and helpful.
Great. Thank you. Happy to have been invited, and I would be happy to help any of you in any way that I can and your career path.
Thank you. Everybody have
Thank you very much, Dr. Jones. A lot of great advice.
All right, great.
Thank you.
Have a nice rest of the day.
All right, bye-bye.